The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
This is Paul, and I'll be reading from the National Geographic Magazine, May 2026, an article entitled Secrets of the Bees, the Hidden Genius of One of Nature's Most Essential Creatures. We know that bees are pollinators that feed the planet. What science is now learning is that they are far smarter than we ever imagined. Here's how that discovery could change what we think about one of the world's most important animals. In a mountain valley in northern New Mexico, both humans and bees were preparing for winter. At Adelina Nucero's adobe home, in the Native American community of Taos Pueblo, a huge pile of firewood lay beside two stacks of rectangular beehives caked with red propolis, a resinous mixture that bees use to seal their homes for the coming months of cold and scarcity. Indigenous beekeeper and National Geographic explorer Melanie Kirby donned a lightweight mesh veil and pried open one of Lucero's hives, pulling out the hanging frames and examining them to locate the colony's queen, which was twice the size of the workers. Quote, "This is our mother breeder," end quote, she said as Lucero looked on. Quote, "She's survived many seasons," end quote. That's sadly uncommon these days. Bees around the globe have been dying off in massive numbers, suffering an onslaught of woes. Parasites, pathogens, pesticides, dwindling habitat. We've learned of these declines mostly from honeybees, whose lives are intertwined with human agriculture, because beekeepers haul millions of hives to pollinate everything from almonds to apples, as well as dozens of other fruits and vegetables. Along with the 20,000-plus other bee species, they help pollinate roughly a third of the planet's food supply and ensure the reproduction of more than three-quarters of all flowering plants. While we know less about wild bees, population surveys indicate that bees worldwide are in decline. From solitary species like leafcutter bees that nest alone and pollinate a few preferred plants, to social ones like native bumblebees that live in colonies and collect nectar and pollen from nearly any flower they encounter. In April 2025, American beekeepers reported that 55% of their colonies had perished over the previous year, their worst losses ever. Kirby's honeybees, however, are thriving. She spent the past 20 years working with her farming partner, Mark Spitzig, to breed and raise colonies, cleverly branded, quote, longevibes, end quote, that are well adapted to New Mexico's high desert and the Rocky Mountain region. Kirby and Spitzig don't treat their hives with the synthetic chemicals most commercial beekeepers use to fend off the varroa mite, an invasive parasite that feeds on bees, weakening colonies and carrying viruses, and is thought to be the primary culprit in recent die-offs. Instead, they wait to breed their queens until after they've lived for at least 2 years, long enough to prove the bees are hardy and wily enough to survive on their own. Ten years ago, Kirby brought some of those bees to Lucero, who creates candles, balms, and salves from the beeswax she harvests. Kirby's instructions were simple. Leave the bees mostly alone, and let them learn to solve the challenges of their volatile world. And they have. Quote, they really can figure things out, end quote, said Lucero. Over the past few decades, scientists have been learning more and more about the ways that bees figure things out. They've studied how honeybee foragers fan out across miles of unfamiliar terrain in their 6-week adult lifespan, navigating by sunlight and memory as they visit thousands of flowers to retrieve nectar for their colonies. They've followed bees back to their nests and seen how they dance to tell others where the best flowers are, and how to make collective decisions to swarm and relocate their homes. Now researchers are uncovering remarkable new insights into how these industrious insects think. The breakthroughs have arrived thanks to a series of creative experiments designed to test how bees perceive the world, solve problems, and respond to unexpected situations. And the results have found that a single bee is much smarter than almost anyone imagined. These tiny creatures can make the sort of intelligent decisions that scientists previously believed were possible only in vertebrates. Kirby's sturdy and resistant bees also hint at a tantalizing possibility for people who are concerned about the insect's long-term survival. As she sees every day in her apiaries, bees can adapt to the increasingly challenging surroundings if we let them. There was a time not long ago when scientists believed that bees were automatons, mindless robots whose actions were hardwired into their genes. Even the most eminent scholars of animal behavior believed that bees' actions were guided purely by instinct. Quote, inherited through countless generations, end quote, wrote German scientist Karl von Frisch, who won a Nobel Prize in 1973 for discovering how bees communicate. Quote, the brain of a bee is the size of a grass seed and is not made for thinking, end quote. But in recent decades, researchers like behavioral ecologist Lars Chitka have designed a series of increasingly ambitious experiments that reveal the many ways that bees' brains are indeed made for thinking. In 1990, when Chitka was studying bee neurobiology as a PhD candidate in Berlin, he led a group of undergraduates to a gigantic agricultural field to explore how bees estimate distance and direction in a featureless landscape with no trees, bushes, or hills. Over a bottle of Irish whiskey one night, they decided, as a joke, to design an experiment to see whether bees could count. Quote, we initially laughed. It was a ridiculous idea, end quote, he recalls. But the next day they constructed a row of identical tent-shaped objects to act as landmarks for a colony of honeybees going back and forth to their hive. They placed a feeder filled with sugar water to mimic nectar between the third and fourth landmarks. Then, once the bees were familiar with the location of the feeder, the students varied the tent's positions. The bees, however, still searched for the feeder after the third tent. They seemed to count the number of landmarks they passed on their way to the feeder. At the time, quote, at the time that raised some eyebrows, end quote. Chitka says, but other labs replicated the results and confirmed his findings. The success of that experiment, he says, quote, triggered me to probe even deeper into how much intelligence you could squeeze into a microbrain like that, end quote. Now a professor at Queen Mary University of London, Chitka has become well known for designing studies in custom-made testing arenas, confronting bees with unusual problems that they would never see in nature. He has switched from using honeybees as his primary subjects to bumblebees, which live in smaller colonies that are easier to observe inside a lab. By introducing bees to challenges, quote, that none of their ancestors ever came across in their evolutionary past, end quote. He says, his team explores the limits of the insect's cognitive flexibility, their ability to alter their behavior as situations change. His pioneering work has spurred a growing body of research demonstrating that bees can recognize patterns, differentiate between symbols, identify human faces, cooperate on novel tasks, and plan for the future. These unexpected abilities may stem from the unpredictable world that bees must negotiate. Foraging insects have to process more complex information than other insects. To retrieve nectar for their colonies, for instance, bees must search across miles to locate the sweetest and rowdiest blooms, remember where they are, and on the fly, literally, perform cost-benefit analyses to determine whether the energy required to reach a sweeter flower is worth traveling the extra distance from the hive. They also must find water, dodge predators, and navigate a shifting compass of sun and sky. Social bees communicate that information to their sisters. Solitary bees bear the additional burden of foraging, nest building, and tending their young all alone. Quote, there are an awful lot of fairly nifty tricks that animals use to survive that are not the result of individual intelligence, end quote, Chitka says, such as building hexagonal honeycombs, or in the case of a human toddler, learning to walk. But, quote, intelligence is the broadest sense has come about by individual learning, end quote. It goes beyond genetic programming. Quote, no human being innately knows how to ride a bicycle, end quote, he adds. Quote, that's something you have to learn, end quote. So must a bee learn to find and remember a patch of flowers. One of the most radical leaps forward in understanding bee intelligence arose from another experiment that Chitka created, half in jest. At a department meeting a decade ago, one of his colleagues lamented that the parrots in his lab had failed a string-pulling test, a classic experiment used to evaluate cognitive prowess in primates, dogs, and various bird species, in which an animal learns to pull a string to retrieve an otherwise inaccessible reward. Quote, I sort of flippantly commented, I bet our bumblebees could do that. Everyone laughed and said, oh, Lars has gone completely crazy, end quote. But Chitka thought about it some more and brought the idea up with his students. Quote, I said, why don't we try? Why don't we just try, end quote. After tinkering with a range of designs, his team placed an artificial flower, a blue dot filled with a sucrose solution, under a low, transparent plastic barrier, so the bees could see but not reach the reward. Instead, they were shown step by step how to pull the flower closer using the attached string. Shortly after the experiment's design was finalized, one of Chitka's students called him into the lab. Quote, "I couldn't believe what I was seeing," end quote, he remembered. The bumblebees had quickly figured out how to pull it to them. Then Chitka and his team decided to expand the classic framework by bringing untrained bees to watch demonstrator bees pull the string. The observers learned the task as well, and soon these bees were showing other foragers in the colony how to do it too. Quote, "The fact that a completely non-natural behavior spread rapidly through an entire population was pretty spectacular," end quote, he said. "The experiment suggested that bees can recognize cause and effect, how pulling a string can produce a reward, and engage in social learning." Bees' surprisingly cognitive abilities also made Chitka begin to consider another radical idea. Quote, "If they're that clever, maybe they can also feel things," end quote, "and are sentient, like humans and other animals, possessing the capacity to experience positive and negative emotions. In order to test for this sort of consciousness, Chitka and his team designed a set of robotic crab spiders, simulating dreaded predators, to briefly capture test bees as if in an unsuccessful attack. Afterward, the bees, quote, whole demeanor changed, end quote, he said. They'd inspect every flower carefully before landing and reject safe ones for the fear of another spider. Quote, "That did look a bit like post-traumatic stress disorder, when you're conjuring up threats from the past," end quote, he explained. In a different experiment, when bees encountered an unexpected rewards, they engaged in more optimistic behaviors, like approaching unfamiliar flowers more quickly. This doesn't mean, as Chitka wrote in his 2022 book, The Mind of a Bee, that the insects, quote, ponder the arc of their life from youth to death, end quote. But he believes it may show that they feel pain, fear, joy, and perhaps even hope. Quote, "In addition to the well-justified motivation to conserve bees because they're useful animals," end quote, Chitka says, quote, "I think the insight that they are intelligent and quite possibly sentient beings lends additional motivation to do something to look after them," end quote. Around the globe, a growing cadre of bee researchers is now trying to measure and understand how bees change their behaviors to solve and survive new challenges. And that means dreaming up even more outlandish obstacle courses. Inside a small laboratory at the University of Oulu in Finland last October, behavioral ecologist Olli Luukkola and doctoral researcher Ashke Bambori watched as a large buff-tailed bumblebee tried to negotiate a rectangular testing area. Bambori had placed a fake flower, a blue dot the bee had been taught to associate with a sugary reward, on the ceiling, hidden from the bee's view as it entered the maze-like area from its hive. He then put a foam ball about the size of a shooter marble in the testing ground. Without any prior training, The bee had to roll the ball to the dot, then clamber onto it like a step stool. Bumblebees typically scramble into flowers rather than hovering around them. If the bee could roll the ball under the flower, climb up, and probe the dot for nectar using its proboscis within a prescribed time limit, it passed the test. The experiment is an extension of work that Lukola and Chitka pioneered when Lukola was a postdoctoral researcher in Chitka's London lab. Building on Chitka's string-pulling experiments, Lukola had taught bees to, quote, play soccer, end quote, training them to roll a small yellow ball to a floral, quote, goal, end quote, to reach a nectar reward, another remarkable demonstration of bees' ability to learn. But this new trial is even more challenging. It could demonstrate that they can, without previous experience, establish an objective, the sugary reward, remember it when it's out of sight, and then use the ball as a tool to reach their objective. If the trial is successful, it will prove that bees are capable of something similar to, quote, insight learning, end quote, solving problems through sudden, quote, aha, end quote, moments, rather than trial and error. This is, quote, true intelligence or complex cognition, end quote, said Lukola. Quote, the animal needs to really understand what they're doing, end quote. The bee they were observing did seem to understand the task at hand, though she was clumsy. After exploring the arena for a while, she nudged the ball, then crawled up onto it and flipped it back over on herself. Many bees roll the ball backward this way, moving their bodies in the direction they want to go. She somersaulted awkwardly, tumbled with the ball, and abandoned it a few times, then finally rolled herself and the ball to the reward's location, climbed up on the ball, and plunged her proboscis into the dot. She had passed the test with time to spare. Lukola and his team encountered some healthy scientific trial and error of their own as they designed the experiment, reworking the testing arena a number of times. Though their work is ongoing, the results look promising so far. And if they prove out, it will be, Lukola said, quote, the first evidence in any insects where we show that they can solve problems spontaneously. While the highly controlled environment in the lab that allowed Lukola and Chitka to investigate the outer bounds of a bee's cognitive abilities, other colleagues have found ways to witness and corroborate bee intelligence in nature. In California, UC Davis biologist and National Geographic explorer Felicity Muth has demonstrated that lone bumblebee queens are even faster and better learners than the foraging worker bees used by Chitka and Lukola. Perhaps because these queens have to forage, build, and provision their nests all alone in the first weeks of their lives. In one experiment, Muth placed strips of colored paper dipped in sugar water or plain water in a meadow. The queens learned to visit the colors that contained sugar water more quickly than the workers did. In France, University of Toulouse behavioral ecologist Mathieu Lihoreau has glued tiny magnetic transponders onto the backs of humblebees to track how bees constantly alter their routes as plants, flowers, and weather patterns change, with an aim of developing a predictive model for how bees visit flowers. Understanding the way bees think and adjust could not only help farmers plant agricultural pollination to increase crop yield, it could also be used in conservation efforts, such as aiding in pollination of endangered plant populations. Like the bees they study, Lihoru, Muth, Lucola, and Chitka have had their share of revelations as they've come to understand how bees negotiate a radically shifting landscape with agility and vigor, and just how vastly we've underestimated the capabilities of their tiny brains. Perhaps, bee advocates suggest, we've also misjudged the insect's ability to adapt to the raft of new challenges, like the parasitic varroa mites that continue to devastate the beekeeping industry. Kirby, for one, has come to believe this is the case, at least where honeybees are concerned. Beekeepers have for too long been stuck on a treadmill of chemical treatments to fend off the mites. But eventually those treatments stop working, and we see huge die-offs like the one last year. Working with a group of like-minded beekeepers, researchers, and scientists, Kirby founded the Adaptive Bee Breeders Alliance, a national network that promotes beekeeping practices that align with the insect's instincts and intelligence, encouraging the breeding of bees that have shown to be resilient in their climate and environments. More beekeepers are beginning to embrace the notion that the best and strongest bees are the ones that survive on their own. Zia Queen Bees, the company Kirby owns with Spitzig, sells as many as 300 queens each year, each week, during spring and summers, to beekeepers across the country. And bigger, more commercial operations are also beginning to come around to this point of view. Quote, "Don't tell the bees how to do their job," end quote, says beekeeper and breeder Randy Oliver, who keeps 1,500 colonies, around 60 million bees, in California. Quote, "Just promote the ones that do," end quote. A bee's job, we've come to understand, is to learn its world, to navigate and remember its ever-changing surroundings to support its colony. And perhaps our job as humans is to support bees in their process of learning and adaptation, being mindful of the habitat they need and the poisons and stresses they don't. Humans need to learn to listen to the bees around them, says Kirby. Quote, "I always feel like the bees still have so much more to teach us," end quote. End. This is Paul, and I'll be reading from the National Geographic magazine of May 2026, an article entitled, "Why the Antarctic Seafloor is a Time Machine." To learn about ancient marine ecosystems, Christian Lager is exploring some of the coldest, deepest places on the planet. Written by David Montgomery. Reporting in this article is presented by the National Geographic Society in partnership with Rolex under the National Geographic and Rolex Perpetual Planet Ocean Expeditions. From its desolate, frozen crust, Antarctica seems like a place unsuited for life. But just offshore, the depths of the Southern Ocean tell a different story. Hundreds of feet below the surface, there are translucent ice fish guarding their eggs, octopuses lolling in the undersea current, and alien-looking isopod crustaceans creeping among a colorful menagerie of sponge and sea stars. Quote, "It blows your mind," end quote, says marine biologist and National Geographic explorer Christian Lager. Quote, at the bottom of the sea, Antarctica is a rich continent with many species, colors, textures, and shapes. End quote. During a recent expedition, Lager peered into those frozen, frigid depths from a control room of the Schmidt Oceans Institute research vessel, Falkor 2, as live video from its remotely operated vehicle, Sebastien, streamed on a monitor. His research team had reached a previously undocumented patch of ocean floor trench, where Sebastien explored a gently sloped area from a depth of more than 3,000 feet to about 1,000 feet. Lager and his colleagues felt like astronauts exploring a new frontier. The Southern Ocean plays an outsized role in the health of our planet by absorbing more human-caused carbon dioxide than any other ocean and regulating the climate through its currents and seasonal ice. But as a recent NASA-supported study notes, current carbon sink estimates are limited because, quote, harsh conditions there make collecting good data difficult, end quote. So, little of the seabed has been studied and much remains unknown. By probing its deep reaches, Lager and his team, who are based at the National Scientific and Technical Research Council of Argentina, hope to discover new species and update carbon storage estimates. The team members collected samples from 7 dives to the seabed during a 3-week voyage as part of the National Geographic and Rolex Perpetual Planet Ocean Expeditions, a project sending researchers to study the Earth's oceans. They deployed Sebastien's mechanical arms to gather filter feeders to help identify new species and core samples from the ocean floor to analyze how much carbon they absorb. The team also brought back video of the terrain. Several of these dives reached depths of more than 2,000 feet, and one descended nearly 13,000 feet, one of the deepest ROV dives ever recorded in the Southern Ocean, offering a unique perspective into the ecology of the seafloor, or the benthic zone. As shallower waters and the land are gripped by the effects of climate change, deeper environments have stayed relatively pristine. Lager explains, there are temperatures that have likely been stable for centuries, and the ocean bottom has been mostly undisturbed. It's, quote, like a time machine, end quote, Lager says, quote, as if we can see what marine communities were like hundreds of years ago, end quote. The dives provided a rare opportunity to create a baseline of deep sea health, so scientists can detect early signs of change in the future. Today, the team is processing samples and examining some 40 hours of video footage to gain a better understanding of ecosystems at various depths on the ocean floor. Laga, who is also a director of the Conservation Foundation for El Mar, believes data from this expedition will strengthen the case for designating more marine protected areas around Antarctica. It, quote, is not only about preserving unique and largely pristine ecosystems, end quote, he explains, quote, but about safeguarding the health of the Southern Ocean and its role in the Earth's systems, end quote. As he points out, quote, what happens at the frozen edge does not stay there, end quote. The end. This is Paul, and I'll be reading from the National Geographic magazine, May 2026, an article entitled, 6 Million on the Move. In a remote corner of South Sudan, researchers recently discovered the world's largest overland migration, an unfathomable parade of antelope that remained hidden from view during decades of war. Now, as conflict recedes and development rushes in, a new problem looms. Can this incredible spectacle be saved? For most of the past half century, one of the planet's greatest wildlife spectacles has unfolded almost entirely unseen. South Sudan spans nearly 250,000 square miles across East Africa, and it's covered in vast and fertile floodplains, savannas, and grasslands. But due to decades of brutal conflict, first to gain independence from Sudan, which was achieved in 2011, then a civil war from 2013 to 2018, the country's natural wonders have largely remained a secret to the outside world. Scientists from the nonprofit Wildlife Conservation Society realized that something special was happening there in 2007, when a short peace agreement gave them a window to conduct a brief aerial survey of the landscape. What they found was extraordinary. Seemingly endless herds of animals traversing the grasslands in an unbroken stream. Each year, millions of antelope, primarily white-eared cob, along with tiangs, reedbuck, and mongala gazelles, move in a sweeping circuit across southeastern South Sudan. During the dry season, they funnel toward permanent water and greener grasses in places like the Sud Wetland and Boma National Park. When the rains return, they disperse again, spreading across tens of thousands of square miles. That early survey documented more than 1.3 million animals. More recent aerial counts conducted by the conservation nonprofit African Parks, using high-resolution imagery and machine learning analysis, indicate the population approaches 6 million, far exceeding the famous wildebeest migration of East Africa. It is the largest land mammal migration on Earth. Today, the relative peace in the region has brought new pressures, as people looking to restart their lives or expanding settlements, hunting bushmeat to feed their families or help make a living, and in some places, weighing whether oil extraction might be a path to prosperity. At this critical moment, an emerging core of guardians is finding ways to keep the migration alive. Here, five of the area's most essential voices share their own stories about the phenomenon and what they're doing to ensure it continues. Mike Fay, the ecologist who revealed the migration to the world. In 2007, I flew a small plane over the swamps and savannas of South Sudan. From above, I saw a world untouched by development, no roads, almost no people, a landscape frozen by conflict. I had heard this war-torn expanse might hide something spectacular. Sure enough, as we began our aerial survey, herds of antelope appeared everywhere by the thousands. It blew my mind. Many experts had assumed these herds were gone, wiped out by the fighting. But it appeared that the war might have actually lowered the hunting of the migratory herds. With people displaced or focused on fighting, there was no transport system for commercial hunting, which created a dynamic that allowed the animals not only to survive, but to possibly thrive while the fighting took place mostly in populated areas. It felt like going back in time. I remember following one river of animals for minutes on end. It was like imagining North America when bison still blanketed the plains. There's really nothing else like it on the continent. Most of Africa's landscapes have been heavily altered, fragmented by roads, settlements, agriculture, and resource extraction. In countries such as Kenya, Uganda, or Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, the only remaining natural areas are inside protected parks. But in South Sudan, vast ecosystems are still intact, unbroken by infrastructure and full of wildlife that move freely over huge tracts of land. Now our challenge is to keep this migration alive. Ironically, peace can be as perilous as war for wildlife. South Sudan is building roads, oil exploration is underway, and bushmeat hunting has increased with a newfound freedom of movement. It's not about never hunting. It's about doing it in a way that keeps populations healthy and landscapes intact. If unchecked, these threats could fragment this great migratory corridor. So we're racing to work with South Sudanese communities to safeguard the herds. Locals here value these animals. Many remember how abundant wildlife was decades ago, and they want those days back. We're helping establish community conservancies and anti-poaching patrols. Since communities collectively own their own land, they have a real stake in managing the wildlife. Together, we're designating key calving grounds and water holes as no hunting zones and security corridors for the animals' passage. I always tell people we're not trying to rewild this place. It's already wild. That's the opportunity here. Manage before it's destroyed. What keeps me up at night is the pace of change, unregulated land use, oil, roads. Once the landscape is broken up, it's hard to put back together. But right now, the wildlife is still here. The movement is still happening, and we have a shot of doing it right, as told to Gordy McCross. The government official balancing conservation with development. Dine Jock Chakor, South Sudan's Minister of Wildlife Conservation and Tourism. I grew up in a pastoral area where wildlife was part of everyday life. From a young age, we were always alert, watching for lions that could attack cattle or for other animals that could harm people. It was normal for us. Wildlife was not something separate from life. It was something we lived alongside. For a long time, this migration was overlooked because this land was neglected by the government. Before South Sudan was a country, there was no interest in development here. No roads, no infrastructure. Villages were isolated, and the land was treated as empty. When I became governor in 2020 and worked directly with African Parks, I began thinking seriously about how wildlife protection and development could work together. South Sudan's economy depends heavily on oil, with some mineral resources. But we also have wildlife, something that can bring long-term value. If protected, this migration can attract people from around the world. Tourism can bring revenue. That is where my passion comes from. Putting those pieces together and introducing this to the world. It hasn't been easy. Many communities around the parks have lived for generations by hunting bushmeat. When we tell them that they can't do this anymore, there's pushback. They ask, what will they get in return? Without jobs or alternatives, it's very difficult. That's why we are working on outreach at the same time as enforcement, educating communities while cracking down on commercial poaching. Land use is another major challenge. We've already stopped proposed roads from cutting through national parks because they would disrupt migration routes. We're making park boundaries and passing laws so these protections can't be changed later. And we've learned from past mistakes, like the Jungli Canal, a massive unfinished drainage project begun under Sudanese rule, built near the Sud wetlands, which would have disrupted seasonal flooding, and which altered wildlife migration routes long before South Sudan became a country. This can't be done by the government alone. We need outside investors to help build our tourist infrastructure. Recently, I took someone from Qatar to visit several national parks. We flew to Boma National Park and to Bagdjigil, landed near the camps, and saw the animals. I want people to have a real visual sense of what's here before they decide to invest. When it's time, we will fully open to tourists. But tourism must be done carefully. Safety must be 100%, not 99%. We aren't fully ready yet, but we are preparing. This is a long-term vision. With peace, stability, and strong laws, we can build infrastructure. Hotels, roads, schools, clinics, and create jobs for local communities. People are proud when they learn the largest land animal migration in the world is here. They want it protected, and we are determined to make sure it benefits the country and its people, as told to GM. The cartographer mapping invisible corridors before they vanish. Inge van der Mirecke, Data Collection Manager, African Parks, South Sudan. This migration isn't animals moving across empty land. It's animals moving through villages, around roads, past farms, towards water, and away from danger. I use software called Geographic Information Systems, GIS, to layer animal movement, time, rainfall, and human activity together to reveal patterns and relationships that aren't visible from the ground or even from the air. Without mapping those layers together, you're seeing only fragments of the story. With data from collared animals, aerial surveys, satellite imagery, and field observations, we can begin to understand how the migration actually works, where animals go in different seasons, how fast they move, and where they return year after year. What surprised me most is how adaptive they are. If rainfall shifts, they shift. If human activity increases, they change their routes. In the northern part of the migration landscape, where settlements and roads are expanding along a canal, I mapped current wildlife tracks and historical movement alongside hand-annotated images of villages and infrastructure. When all those layers came together, it became clear that some remaining wildlife corridors were only a few kilometers wide. In some places, animals were crossing roads at night, moving quickly through the last available gaps to reach water. Without protecting those corridors now, they could disappear entirely. That's why we're currently working on an official land use plan. It's essential, but incredibly difficult. Millions of people live in this landscape. There's pastoralism, agriculture, oil development, traditional land ownership, and wildlife all sharing the same space. The land use plan brings everything together. Migration routes, breeding areas, villages, roads, oil blocks, development areas. So coexistence is still possible. Poaching is part of this reality. We use the data we've gathered on where we've seen carcasses and where we've seen hunters to identify bushmeat hotspots. But enforcement is complex. In some areas, communities have their own legal systems. Protection has to be negotiated, community-based, and informed by data. We don't have 10 years to wait for the perfect science. The animals don't have that time. The maps don't make the challenge simpler, but they show us where decisions matter most, and where acting now could still make a difference. As told to GM. The conservation officer walking hundreds of miles to lobby for wildlife. Oleo Coco, member of African Parks Tango teams, who work with communities to protect the animals. There are 54 community engagement personnel divided into 9 teams. They call us TANGOs, which is shorthand for Transhumanist Engagement Officials. Usually I work with Dennis Kaka and Philip Kaka. We work every day, moving from one cattle camp or village to another. Sometimes the distance between camps takes more than a day to walk. Last dry season, we covered around 375 miles. When we arrive in a community, the first thing we do is call the chief, who then gathers the elders and the people. We sit down together and introduce ourselves, who we are, where we come from, and the organization we work for. We tell them we're there to talk about conservation, about protecting wildlife, that if we don't protect it, one day it will disappear, and there'll be nothing left for us to depend on. We also speak to children, who often chase down cob with dogs and kill them for their meat. We tell them that if we don't protect these animals, one day you won't see them again. If you want meat, speak to your family. Don't just kill and leave the animal there. That's not a good habit. Another important part of our work is supporting Mul communities in the East, whose culture revolves around transhumanists, or the seasonal movement of their livestock. We bring veterinary medicine. When cattle are sick, we treat them. We explain to the community why we do this. We want your cattle to stay alive, so that you depend on your cattle and not wildlife. If cattle are healthy, people don't need to hunt as much. People listen because we're from the same community. We're from the same clan. They know our families. They know we're not lying to them. In rural culture, if someone from your community speaks to you, you listen because you know they want something good for you. Before we started this work, people killed wildlife without thinking. Now they know that wildlife is important. They remember that before poaching becomes widespread. Animals were everywhere, zebras, elephants, cob. Now many of them are gone. They don't want everything to disappear. But talking alone is sometimes not enough. Some people agree with us when we're there, but then they keep hunting after we've left. That's why we believe customary law is important. If chiefs and elders enforce traditional rules together with us, people will really change, because then there are consequences. This work is difficult. We walk long distances, sometimes without water or food. but we keep at it because we know we're working for our people. If we stop, there will be no one to explain why wildlife matters, as told to GM. The King charting a sustainable path for the future. Akwe Akada, Akwe Cham, 24th monarch of the Ayuka Kingdom of Western Ethiopia and South Sudan. As a boy, I hunted. Everyone did. We hunted for meat, for skins, for daily needs. When you go out and see so many animals together, you don't forget it. So when I later learned that this migration is considered the largest animal migration on Earth, it surprised me only in the sense of the title. We always knew there were many. But I have seen what happened to other animals, the poaching. Zebras are gone from places where they once lived. Many elephants were killed, and the rest moved away. That's because of poaching. It makes me sad, especially about zebras. And it makes me afraid that the same thing could happen to the cob. The cob are important to our culture. We depend on them in many ways. Meat, skins for sleeping. Sometimes people hunt and sell to the market to get money for schooling for children. If the cob disappear, it will be devastating to our community. In the past, we didn't have a system to protect animals. People hunted freely. But what changed is the scale. Before, our numbers were not many. Now the numbers have grown, and hunting has grown. That is not good. I left my village where Sudan was still one country and went to Khartoum to get an education when I was about 17. When the war intensified, I managed to go to Kenya and became a refugee. Then the resettlement process came, and I went to the United States and lived in Minnesota. Living there showed me that hunting doesn't mean taking everything. People hunt, but with limits. There are rules, and those rules are followed. You can't just go and kill as many animals as you want. That stayed with me. Protection is possible when systems exist. My brother was the king before me. When he died, I was called back to take his place. That is why I returned, to save our people. And when I became king, conservation became important right away. The cob are connected to future generations of the Aniuak. I understand why poaching happens. People want money so their children can go to school. But the government needs strong rules and strong punishment for those who hunt without control. I do not say hunting must stop completely, but no guns and no dogs would be good. Still, it is difficult. Without enough rangers, people will go crazy and kill animals. In the best future, the cob will still be there. There will be peace, and tourism will come. People will benefit. Communities will benefit. The national government will get revenue. With development, roads, schools, hospitals, clean water, we will transform for the better. As told to GM.
Are you having difficulty with your eyesight? Are you losing your vision? Are you afraid of what comes next? If you're blind or visually impaired, contact Mass Commission for the Blind to find out if you're eligible to register for services. Learn new skills to reclaim your independence. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.